Welcome to Korean Context, a behind-the-scenes conversation with the scholars, artists and opinion makers that bridge our two worlds. My name's Chad O'Carroll and I'll be your host today. Years ago on this very day, June 25th, the Korean War broke out. A conflict in which hostilities only ended due to the signing of what everybody thought would only be a temporary armistice. Who would have thought, 6 decades later, a state of war would still prevail on the peninsula and that North Korea would have developed nuclear weapons? To remember the past and talk about the future, for this special episode, Korean Context spoke to Lieutenant General Robert G. Gard Jr., current chairman of the Center for Arms Control and Non-Proliferation, and Korean War veteran. Having fought in the war and maintained a close interest in the peninsula through his work on the North Korea nuclear issue, Korean Context thought that General Gard would be an ideal person to talk to about both the war and the future of North Korea diplomacy. In this episode, Gard tells us about his role during the war, his early impressions of Korea, what went wrong with nuclear diplomacy, and what the United States should do moving forward on the peninsula. General Robert Gard has an impressive resume, having seen combat in both the Korean and Vietnam Wars, served as executive assistant to 2 Secretaries of Defense, presided over the National Defense University, and held senior postings at both Johns Hopkins and the Monterey Institute of International Studies. To start out this episode of Korean Context, I asked General Gard to talk about the circumstances through which he was initially deployed to Korea.
Well, it was quite anomalous. I graduated from West Point in early June of 1950, just before the war started. And the policy then was that we would go straight to troops. Now, some of us gung-ho young lieutenants signed up for airborne duty and so on, and the more mature members of my class picked nice places like Hawaii and Fort Lewis, Washington. So when the balloon went up, when the North invaded the South, they were sent immediately to Korea without any branch training even. Those of us that went to the 82nd Airborne were frozen in position because the 82nd was the only General Reserve Division in the United States. So the gung-hos got frozen and the more mature people got sent to war immediately. So I was frozen in the 82nd for a couple of years, and I did not get to Korea until the fall of 1952.
Okay, so it started obviously, and what was your role then when you actually went out there?
Well, by the time I got there, I was a first lieutenant, not a second lieutenant anymore. And I was assigned to command a separate field artillery battery located in the center of Korea. It was a core artillery unit, not part of a division. And we actually fired in support of the South Korean Army. I had a 155 gun battery, the longest range weapons the U.S. had at the time. So we were positioned well forward to take advantage of that. And even though it was almost a World War I type scenario at that time, we were under direct observation of the Chinese and would receive calling cards in the form of incoming Chinese artillery from time to time. But as a separate battery commander, I ran my own fire direction. I had a great deal of independence, was beefed up with a self-propelled gun in addition to the 4 in the battery. And it was like commanding a very small battalion.
Wow. So you were quite close then, I guess, to what's now the DMZ, I imagine.
Yes, we were well forward, and so toward the end, before the armistice was signed, when the Chinese made a final demonstration of strength by attacking in large numbers, We were pumping out rounds as fast as safety would allow in the hope that we wouldn't get overrun.
Right.
We didn't.
But neither did, neither was the North, I guess, overrun in the long term, and we've been left with this stalemate ever since. Did you ever, in your wildest dreams, think we'd still be where we are today back then?
Well, I don't think I thought that far ahead as to whether we would still have 28,500 troops in South Korea, some fairly close to the demilitarized zone. In fact, I just read a day or two ago that even though the bulk of American troops is to pull back south of Seoul, they're going to keep an artillery unit closer to the DMZ and beef it up with some multiple launch rocket systems, which are precisely the right sort of weapon to be able to use in the highly unlikely event that the North should decide to invade the South.
Mm-hmm. And going back to your deployment to Korea, when you went there, did you have did you have any information about the country? Did you know where you were going? Because some of the other veterans we spoke to for our gala recently, they were fresh into the military and were being dispatched and had no idea what enemy they were really fighting in defense of.
Well, since I was delayed a little more than 2 years before I got there, by then I was well aware of what was going on in South Korea. Some say that we suffered a defeat there. I don't feel that way. We were able to expel the North Korean army from the South and reinstate the independence of the South. I understood, particularly in the Cold War context of the time, that we looked on it as a zero-sum game, that any augmentation of territory under communist control was a defeat for us. And consequently, the president decided we would take a stand in South Korea, and I understood it in that context.
Mm-hmm. And, what do you really remember most about the war and some of your early impressions of Korea as it was back then?
Well, of course, I knew almost nothing about Korea when the war started. It was, of course, occupied by Japan until the end of the Second World War. It was a very poor country. And when I got there and got to know some of the Koreans, I actually had what were called KATUSAs, Korean Army trainees with U.S. forces, in my field artillery battery and got to know some of them. And I had great admiration and respect for the South Korean people.
And obviously, Korea's come on a lot since then.
Remarkably so.
Yeah, were you surprised at all seeing what you saw back in the 50s and, contrasting it with what we can see in Seoul today, for example?
Oh, absolutely startling. I did see Seoul. Of course, it was overrun twice by the North and second time with the Chinese. And it was flat, rubble. And I've been back a few times since and never cease to marvel at the progress, the energy, the dynamism of the South Korean people.
Now, some people call the Korean War the Forgotten War. Others dispute that to some extent. What were your impressions of the way you and colleagues were received back in the United States when you returned home?
Well, I did not perceive the sort of hostility toward the members of the armed forces that occurred after the Vietnam War. Of course, the war became very unpopular when it dragged out and casualties continued and negotiations failed. And General Eisenhower, when he ran for president, said, "I will go to Korea and I will end this war," which he did. But I don't think it was forgotten, particularly with what occurred subsequently, the somewhat slow but nevertheless steady progress toward democratization of the country. And now it stands as a beacon of democracy in that part of the world. At first, of course, under Syngman Rhee, it was what you might regard as a, if not totalitarian, at least authoritarian society. But certainly that's not the case any longer.
Mm-hmm. And just rounding up on this section, is there anything that you wish people in the United States, South Korea, even North Korea, anything you wish they knew better about the war?
I don't think so. It's perhaps there's a lack of appreciation now in what the general atmosphere was during these early stages of the Cold War, and a failure to appreciate why that point of view was taken at the time. It's easy to look back now and say, well, you know, the Soviet Union was not aggressive, but it didn't appear that way at the time.
Mm-hmm. And of course, nuclear weapons at one point weren't off the table with Korea.
Well, I think General MacArthur felt that when the Chinese came in that it was a different kind of war and it would be appropriate to use them if necessary. I think, for whatever it's worth, that President Truman was absolutely right to relieve him of his command.
Mm-hmm.
A very courageous decision under the circumstances, because he was very popular. And the Incheon landing, which was his initiative, certainly established him as one of the great captains in history. But unfortunately, his failure to act on what he knew perfectly well was appropriate civil-military relations in this country caused his relief.
Okay, so moving on, North Korea itself might have at one time feel threatened about the use of nuclear weapons against it. Do you think that and the deployment of nuclear weapons in South Korea a few decades ago, do you think those factors in any way contributed towards North Korea's own strategic decision to start developing their nuclear program back in the late 60s?
Oh, I think undoubtedly it did. Then, of course, we pulled our tactical nuclear weapons out of South Korea. Obviously, that didn't mean that we did not continue to have a nuclear capability that could be employed against the North. And I think that there is some validity to the paranoia that the North feels about hostility, comments made about overthrowing the regime and so forth, don't contribute to stabilizing the situation there.
Mm-hmm. And if we take that feeling of threat as being one of the motivations behind North Korea's development of nuclear weapons, how do you think the international community can address that motivation such that it becomes in North Korea's self-interest to denuclearize?
Well, of course, there was an agreement between the North and the South to have a nuclear-free Korean peninsula. Unfortunately, I think we mishandled some of the negotiations in the past. The North Koreans have expressed over and over again the desire for some sort of peace treaty. Since we're operating under an armistice, they're still technically at war.
Mm-hmm.
Between the North-South and the U.S. as part of the so-called NATO forces that operated during the war. I don't see what we gain by refusing to respond to North Korean overtures to see if we can't establish a peace treaty. Perhaps relieving some of the paranoia that they feel about threats from the South. I don't see any good reason why we shouldn't do that.
But the interesting thing is, do you think beneath the rhetoric, North Korea really wants a peace treaty?
It's hard to say. They are so difficult to understand what their motivations really are. But I think back to the agreement of September 2005, agreement of principles that we finally stop demanding complete, verifiable, irreversible disestablishment of the North Korean nuclear program as a precondition to talking with them. And we agreed to go commitment by commitment, action by action. And it was moving along. And then we decided, for whatever reason, that we would insist that what was to come in phase three of that staged negotiation, to move it back into phase two before we would fulfill our commitments under phase two. That broke it up. North Korea knocked off the negotiations, and we've stopped there. And I think it was extremely unfortunate.
Yes, of course, that you're referring, I think, to Condoleezza Rice when she spoke at the Heritage Foundation.
Yes.
And she admitted to, in effect, shifting the goalposts, I think her words were, to describe that. But isn't this part of the problem that US policymakers have when dealing with North Korea? It's, a dictatorship with a major human rights problem. It has the privilege of having the same staff negotiate with the United States for several decades. The United States, unfortunately, has to shift these as the political season changes. Problem being that it's hard, it can sometimes be hard, I think, for politicians and negotiators in the United States to come to agreements because of the domestic pressures. You know, you are open to the charge of making agreements with a totalitarian dictatorship that's abusing human rights, and there are a whole litany of problems that come with it. And as a result of this democratic process, do you in some way think that it's almost impossible for the United States to really come to a long-term agreement with North Korea when it's so politically advantageous to just think of short-term tactical wins?
Well, I think you put your finger on one of the really serious inhibitions for us to conduct diplomacy in a sensible way. But we were progressing after the September 2005 Statement of Principles. We got through phase one. North Korea blew the tower off of its facility at Yongbyon. We were moving ahead, and then for whatever set of reasons, we decided that we were going to move the goalposts. Now, we were making good progress, but you're absolutely right. We've got a legislative body with 535 secretaries of state, and other countries sometimes have difficulty differentiating between the opinions of individual congressmen and the policies of the United States government. So yes, it's very difficult, and it's especially so in an election year. We see a replay of that now in our negotiations with Iran over its program.
What do you say to those, though, that point to, agreed framework, the Sunshine Policy, and they say, well, look, we actually did give engagement a try, it didn't work, Bush was right to demand this verification up front.
No, I don't agree with that. We had the agreed framework. We made certain commitments, but we didn't keep them. I believe we were to start building the two light water reactors in 2 years. 6 years later, we broke ground. We suspended delivering fuel, and we were way behind in the amount that we had delivered. The Congress wouldn't appropriate the funds. We failed to follow through on the agreement that we made. And then finally, when our Secretary of State visited North Korea in 2000, shortly before the end of the Clinton administration, the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, at the beginning of the Bush administration, said he wanted to take up negotiations where they had left off. And the Bush administration decided that it would not conduct those negotiations and broke them off. So I don't think that we gave it a full try.
And what about the current president, Obama? Do you think he was really trying with engaging with North Korea when he came into power? Because, again, people would say he came in with his hand open to talk to these dictators throughout the world, and North Korea started with their April 2009 missile launch, and then 1 month later, a nuclear test. Welcome to negotiations, President Obama.
Well, I think in principle, President Obama was open to trying to reestablish communications. On the other hand, our Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, said that we would not negotiate until the North Koreans demonstrated a commitment to doing away with their nuclear weapons program. We wanted the outcome in advance of any serious negotiations. And so it's been watchful waiting, and we've made no progress. We didn't follow through from the sort of philosophical general approach of opening up negotiations and actually doing so.
But again, this goes back to the domestic politics. How can Clinton not say, look, we're not going to buy the same horse twice? We've seen previous administrations put up the food aid, enter into negotiations, and every time North Korea lets us down. Because the problem, of course, isn't just the US position. North Korea also has not lived up to commitments, and Is it too much to say we need some progress before we understand you're going to be negotiating with sincerity, as they've said? And of course, we also had the Chonin incident and...
Oh, yes. Well, those more recent incidents, of course, created a political atmosphere that made it very difficult to appear to be making any concessions under those circumstances. I was very encouraged after the September 2005 agreement in principle. Of course, what the agreement was that we would respect the sovereignty of North Korea and would not threaten invasion, even though politically some people continued to call for regime change. And then we promptly froze $25 million for almost 2 years in a Macau bank, which clearly was interfering with the sovereignty of North Korea. And we lost 2 years of negotiations. And then when they started again, we were making progress. So I don't think progress is impossible, but you have to have, and I think early in the Obama administration was the time to do it. Now, with the election coming up, it's simply not feasible to do anything because of our domestic political situation.
Right. And of course, we have elections in South Korea this year. Russia also has just changed. China also just coming up. So maybe moving forward, there's going to be a new slate. We've got Kim Jong-un, who's just arrived in North Korea. So What are your hopes for 2013 moving forward past the electoral cycle? How would you say you would want the problem to be dealt with?
Well, I think when a new administration comes in, or if President Obama is reelected, the opportunity then presents itself to take the initiative to get talks underway again. It may be too late. I am much more pessimistic now than I was earlier, because North Korea clearly has an explosive device, how good it is, whether they can miniaturize it, and so on is another question. But they have them. It'll be much harder to get them to give them up than if we had stuck with it before they made their first test.
Yeah, I mean, in conversations you hear in policy circles now, a lot of people rather pragmatically are quite defeatist about the realization of a non-nuclear North Korea at the moment, which makes you think, what's the new focus going to be? Non-proliferation? Of course, President Obama can't say that's the new focus, because it's like a tacit acknowledgement of North Korea as a nuclear state. But what do you think that the United States and South Korea, what do you think their goal actually is beyond non-proliferation in North Korea? Is there one?
Well, I think the goal clearly is to try to establish a degree of stability so hostilities won't break out either by accident or over an incident similar to the sinking of the South Korean naval vessel. And I think that we should take a hard look at trying to sign a peace treaty with all the parties that were involved, for whatever assurance that might provide to the North. I think the perceived threat of the regime to the regime, their fear that our real objective is regime change, which it would be nice if it happened, but it's unlikely that we're going to take the action to trigger it. When you prevent the North from engaging in legitimate commerce, you simply increase their incentive to make use of their nuclear expertise in order to earn foreign exchange. Try to regularize the relationships. Try to get Korea immersed within the world economy, not precluding them from participating in it. I think that's the direction we should be going after the next election.
And just to round up, what do you think North Korea should be doing? We've talked a lot about what the other parties should do.
Well, it's awfully hard to get North Korea to change the policies that the new leader is apparently continuing to follow, the example of his father putting the military first. But again, some of that at least may be due to a perceived threat to the continued existence of the regime. So I don't think that we gain very much under the current circumstances by isolating the regime.
Mm-hmm. Okay, General Guard, thank you very much for joining us today in this special episode of Korean Context.
It was my pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. The views expressed in this podcast reflect General Guard's own personal opinions and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Korea Economic Institute. I do hope you enjoyed today's podcast. You can download other episodes at our podcast website, which you can find at keia.podbean.com. That's keia.podbean.com. We'd also really appreciate if you could leave us some feedback using the comment system on either the Podbean website or directly on our iTunes page. If you'd like to suggest a candidate or topic for a future episode, be sure to drop me an email at ocarroll@keia.org. That's ocarroll@keia.org. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you can join us next time.